Good day, and thank you for standing by. My name is Lee, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the second quarter earnings call for Mace Security International Inc. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during that time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Mark Barrett. You may begin your conference.
Thank you, Lee, and good afternoon, everyone. With me this afternoon is Gary Medved, President and Chief Executive Officer of Mace. Please visit mace.com, Investor Relations, /transcripts and presentations, where we have loaded materials for this call. Before proceeding, I would like to point out that certain statements and information during this conference call will constitute forward-looking statements and are based on management expectations and information currently in the possession of management. When used during our conference call, the words or phrases "will likely result," "are expected to," "will continue," "is anticipated," "estimate," "projected," and "intended to," or similar expressions, are intended to identify forward-looking statements. Such statements are subject to certain risks, known and unknown, and uncertainties, including, but not limited to, economic conditions, limited capital resources, and the ability of management to effectively manage the business and integrate acquired businesses. Such factors could materially adversely affect Mace's financial performance. It could cause Mace's actual results for future periods to differ materially from any opinions or statements expressed during this call. I will now turn the call over to Gary to comment on the second quarter 2019 financial results.
Thank you, Mark. First, Mace continues its process of transformation. In the second quarter, we made progress on rolling out our new brand identity, our package redesign, and we completed our website upgrade, while at the same time introducing our recent brand partnerships, Kiro's and USPS, to our customer base. In the second quarter, we also made the difficult decision to discontinue the Less Lethal Munitions business. We made this decision in order to redeploy our resources to businesses that show a higher margin and more robust sales growth. We are continuing serving our less lethal customers in the LE and tactical community through our Takedown gel, Stream, spray, and fogger products. This decision will free up approximately $20,000 per month of capital to redeploy. We have recognized a charge of $140,000 in the quarter for exit obligations, which are substantially complete at this time. The quarter also contains an increase in the reserve for uncollectible accounts, of which two are now in litigation to pursue recovery. I'll turn the call back to Mark to discuss details behind the financial performance.
Thank you, Gary. As to the financial highlights themselves, second quarter net sales were $2,967,000 compared to $2,843,000 last year, an increase of $124,000 or 4.4%. Six-month sales increased to $5,679,000 from $5,207,000 in the 6 months ended June 30, 2018, an increase of 9.1%. The increase in second quarter-over-quarter sales was due to strong performance in our custom, B2B, and international channels, but was partially offset by softness in our brick-and-mortar and our e-commerce channels. The second quarter of 2018 also had $150,000 in revenue from a television shopping channel that we elected to not participate in 2019. Gross profit for the second quarter of 2019 totaled $957,000, with a 32% gross margin, compared to $1.216 million and 43% gross margin in the same period in 2018. The 2019 period includes the $140,000 charge for manufacturing costs attributed to exiting the munitions business, which are booked in cost of sales during the period. This contributed to approximately 5 percentage point drop in the margin. The remainder of the margin drop was due to an increase in manufacturing overhead and labor variances. Several of these variances we did not expect to recur, such as a $50,000 rent catch-up for a property tax case that was on appeal, and the munitions exit cost of $140,000, as discussed above. We also expect these variances to improve as we have devoted additional resources to manufacturing efficiency and supervision. The actual direct margin for product sales before overhead was comparable period over period versus 2018. For the 6 months ended June 30, 2019, gross profit declined to $2,027 from $2,204 in 2019, an 8% decline, and is influenced by the same manufacturing overhead variances occurring in the three-month period. Product margin before overhead was also comparable in the six-month period in 2019 versus 2018. Selling, general, administrative expenses for the second quarter were $1,408,000 compared to $1,085,000 in the same period last year, an increase of $323,000 or 29%. This increase was primarily due to higher accounts receivable reserve, as previously discussed, and the detail of this increase is reconciled in our OTC report and the MD&A discussion. The six-month SG&A costs for 2019 were $3.213 million compared to $2.298 million in 2018, an increase of 39%. The second quarter investments in our packaging redesign and website enhancements of approximately $50,000 are part of the net $32,000 decrease and the other factors discussed in the MD&A. As a result of the above, the company reported a net loss after tax of $606,000 for the second quarter compared to a $41,000 profit in the same period in 2018, a $647,000 decline. Six-month net loss for 2019 was $1,462,000 compared to a loss of $293,000 in the same period in 2018. EBITDA for the second quarter was a negative $481,000 compared to EBITDA of $140,000 positive in the second quarter of 2018 for a $621,000 decline. 6 months ended June 30, 2019 EBITDA was a loss or a negative $1.217 million compared to an $83,000 negative EBITDA in the same period of 2018. Second quarter adjusted EBITDA showed a smaller decline of only $190,000 from $185,000 in 18 to a negative $5,000 in 2019. 6 months adjusted EBITDA declined to negative $228,000 in 19 versus a $1,000 loss in 2018. From a liquidity perspective, we saw a net decrease in cash and cash equivalents of $47,000 from December 31, 2018 to the end of the second quarter. Our line of credit availability was $650,000 as of June 30, 2019. We still anticipate CapEx spending for the year to approximate $100,000. Finally, our tax net operating loss carryover was approximately $60 million available for the second quarter of 2019, which is unchanged from Q1 as we have not yet finalized our 2018 tax filings. I'll now turn the call back to Gary, who will discuss outlook and priorities for 2019.
Thanks, Mark. Turning to operational issues, we continue to vigorously dialogue with our customers about our refreshed packaging, branding, our new branding partnerships. Some of our large brick and mortar customers have cautioned us about an overall category weakness in personal safety, and we have not been immune to that. At the same time, we are investing time and funds into improving our e-commerce capabilities, improving our search results, website user friendliness, product and category awareness, and improved social media awareness. We believe these efforts will help us earn a greater share of the e-commerce channel going forward. At this time, I will stop and open the lines to questions. I would ask each caller to limit themselves to one question with one follow-on to allow everyone a chance to participate. And if we have additional time, we will try to get back into the queue. Operator, please open the line for questions.
Sir, certainly, sir. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. And your first question is from Andrew Sharpio. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you. My first question, my questions initially here are about the new partnerships that you announced at the annual meeting, Investor Day, and recently in a separate release regarding more detail about Kuros, and I'm assuming down the road you'll have more details about the U.S. Postal Service partnership. Regarding the Kuros partnership, can you elaborate a little bit more on the partnership that you recently announced and what is expected from, I guess, basically both parties and the opportunities you see the company having in front of it to take advantage of?
Well, I think first and foremost is the mission behind Kuros and providing women in undeveloped nations pepper spray that allows them to defend themselves and enhances their personal safety as well as their mobility once they have these products in their hands. And we're proud to be a partner of an effort such as that. And what it does for us over in the United States is it is a strong opening to brick and mortar retail. In all the presentations that we made and continue to make, that is our lead-in, explaining the program, the mission behind the program, and it's been extremely well received. What we've done differently is we have redesigned the packaging, and we've added two additional SKUs to the product line. Instead of just the pepper spray, we now have the alarm, then we offer the alarm and the pepper spray in a two-piece kit. We are looking at promotional PDQ displays, developing those, also being very well received by brick and mortar retail. So I think to wrap it all up, it's a strong mission, it's a powerful mission. We're proud to be partners with Kuro, and we just felt that there's a better opportunity to expand the product line and clean up the packaging design and make it just a lot more appealing to the consumer. So that's where we are with the program.
So for a little bit more clarification, is the initial placement or much of the placement where historically Kuros brand product was already offered in the retail and now it'll be a Mace Kuros product, and if that's the case, what was the historical Kuros revenues in their product line and the channels that Mace will now either produce or completely take over responsibility for?
Well, those that are familiar with the program probably know that the previous partner, Kuro, has switched out the product. I wouldn't say switch out the product. They have a very similar looking product that they, over time, have introduced to brick and mortar retail where the Kuros product was. So as it stands, that SKU or that hook space is being occupied, and we have to go into each of these brick and mortar retails and explain, you know, in detail about the new partnership. And they're looking at holistically the Kuros program as well as the Mace program combined. So their decisions have not been made yet on all fronts on where they'll be launching the product, where they'll be placing the product. It would be really beautiful if it was just a one switch, you know, that they would shut one off and turn the other one on. But as it is, they have a competing product out there right now that we have to deal with. So that's where we are with the program. But it's getting in front of all brick and mortar retail. All the buyers have seen it that we've talked to and continue to talk to. So, you know, it's a program that has to be basically be reintroduced to them all over again.
Okay. And is there already some takeaway about the fact that, you know, Kuros and Mace and this joint partnership have a, we'll call it a socially conscious brand, and you are the ones who are providing pepper to women at risk in these developing countries, and the former partner or supplier for Kuros is not doing that. Is that giving you headway and feet in the door?
Yes, it does. But at the same time, you know, they get it, they understand it. Where they did not have the program, they embrace it, okay, but we're still waiting on buyer decisions. And where they did have the program, as I said, there's a competing product in there, not Kuros branded, but a Kuros lookalike, and we have to contend with getting them displaced before we get ours in there. As you know, Andrew, in retail, you know, it's you want something in, something's got to come out.
I guess right. to add to that, it is the product is available in our e-commerce channel at the present time, so you can see it, purchase it on Amazon and on Mace.com, among others. So there has been that switchover has occurred already.
Okay, and can you share what the minimum level of commitment or take Mace is obligated on as part of this agreement, and by when must that level be satisfied?
It's not really like a take or pay. It's a 12-month number that was negotiated, you know, frankly, based on what the product had already been doing with a negotiated ramp-up period in it. So, it's not a take or pay. There's no minimum commitment, but we set a level, you know, together with our partner that was felt by both parties to be pretty comfortable, and it ramps up over time to get to a larger number after the first 12 months. So we definitely
it's a number you're comfortable with. It sounds like.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay. And can you expand? This is the last question on the Kuros thing, and I'll back out. Can you expand on the various, channels that this partnership then is expecting to generate revenues for Mace, and what products are kind of full retail revenue versus wholesale fill revenue, if any, and the timing of this revenue generation. So you've said to move this question forward, you've already said you're offering it on Mace.com, Amazon.com, and maybe other e-commerce partners. And is it already offered and available in some retail, or when does that start to occur and the revenues from that? And are the margins from this net of the royalty, you know, comparable to the retail, or are they more like the wholesale margins?
Well, there are a number of questions in there.
Yep.
First and foremost, on the retail side, there's, you know, your mass retail, your sporting good retail, your hardware channels. They have all seen it, but as I alluded to at our investor day meeting, most of those, if not all of them, don't do their category resets until early next year. So from a meaningful revenue standpoint, you know, we expect to start experiencing that first quarter next year in the second quarter when all these placements take place. And, you know, it's already available, as Mark had mentioned, on the e-commerce channels, Mace.com and Amazon.com. And if anybody adds the product quicker, okay, then all the better. But, you know, these major retailers, they all have a calendar that they go by when they do their category reviews, when they do their category resets. And so all we can do is control the stuff that we can control.
And to the margin point, Andrew, I think as you probably know, the e-commerce channels are a lot closer to full retail margins, where we capture most of that ourselves. And obviously, when we sell through brick and mortar, we're selling at a wholesale price. And I think, as we mentioned maybe on the last call, the royalty number will contribute a bit to the margin decline, but it is still in the neighborhood of all in what we would see overall for similar products. So it's not a burdensome margin by any means. It's something we're very comfortable with.
And is this and then the other channel is international? Is that a product channel that we Mace Kuros joint branded is offered into, or are we just a fill on those?
No, international is an opportunity, and actually, as Kuro does his traveling around the world, he is meeting with our distribution partner. He's in, I think he's currently in Africa right now, and he met with our distributor over there. They're welcoming the program, and he was in the Philippines a month ago and took the program to them, and they're going to add it. And then speaking of international, we, you know, ultimately I want to have one person in-house that handles international with all of our distributors, and I'm close to getting that person. When we do, the Kuros product line will become part of their offering, so it'll get more attention than it has up to this point.
Got it. Thank you for letting me have all those questions on Kuros. I'll back out into the queue, but please come back to me. I have many more.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew.
And your next question comes from Thurman Willis. Your line is now open.
Let me thank you for taking my question. And for those that were not at the annual meeting or the investor day, it was well presented and Gary, you guys did a really good job. I was glad to see that one thing that came from that was insider reporting of buys, and that one of your or several of your directors and or owners bought over 1 million shares. So I appreciate you doing that. But it was an excellent program. I've asked this question before, and I didn't really get satisfactory answer from prior management, so I'm going to ask it again, and if you could be specific in what you're going to do. One of the directors there commented that it was your goal to have Mace in every home in America, and was most impressed, if I might compare it to a sporting event, in that you have a good board, or you have good owners, you have good coaches or managers in your situation, you have a good team or good products, you have a solid game plan or the future growth for earnings and revenues, but you have no fans in the stands. People just absolutely do not know about Mace, and if you could please comment on what you plan to do differently in the way of maybe having weekly calls with wealth managers, non-deal roadshows, and at what point you plan to get fans in the stands, as this could bridge the gap between the revenue increase that you're expecting to have our stock trade at a fair price.
Thanks, Thurman. This is Mark. I'll tackle a couple of those on the IR front. So there is not a tremendous amount of things we can do completely differently, but we do believe that there are some things that we can do, period. So we have gotten made some progress in our external news sources and our communications with news wires, and are trying to be more visible in that space with regard to releases that are important about the company. We don't want to flood the news wires every other day with non-important information, but things like the Kuros partnership and things like the significant purchases by our directors are important for people that follow the company. So that's one thing we're doing. Another plan that we have, now that we've been in place as new management for almost 6 months now, we are going to begin to be more visible with some of the external investment community in the way of smaller, very targeted participation in investor conferences that speak to the micro cap market. It does no good to be in front of groups or institutions that are not interested in micro cap stocks that are traded over the counter. So we're going to
participate in several targeted conferences with the goal of getting our story out there a little bit more, and then you know, very importantly, the follow on to that, because the conferences are nice, but if you get a bunch of business cards and sort of walk away and never make anything further of it, you probably haven't capitalized on your time. So we do also have plans to engage in discussions with a number of IR third parties that, while I don't envision that we'll have any significant spend in any type of outsourcing IR or any type of very significant, formal program with a third party, I think there are best practices that we can probably adopt as an OTC stock that will help with investor relations. So that could result in non-deal roadshows. We do get a relatively steady but modest inbound flow of inquiries from potential investors, and I personally return all those calls and speak to those. We have had several meetings here in place for potential investors, and that dialogue continues periodically with them after the initial meeting. So rest assured, as we get inquiries, we do make every effort to provide them all the information we can. I guess lastly, our social media, and we'll kind of wrap it into content marketing and social media, which both talks about our products and to a degree our company. We feel like we have continued to push along the social media awareness side. We aren't where we want to be. We are engaging in having some additional resources, or more realistically different resources, for our social media and our brand awareness that will bring it both, again, our products as well as our company. So we're gonna have to do things a little bit differently, I think, than we've been doing the last 6 months in terms of social media.
If I could do the follow-up on social media, and some tremendous missed opportunities, not by existing management, by past management, but there's been 256 mass shootings that killed 3 or more people. Maybe I don't understand, but I get the same question from everyone, that Mace products are the only deterrent to possibly reduce these horrific situations and save lives with a non-lethal product. I'm fully aware it's not the only deterrent, but if everyone in all households had Mace products, hopefully these nightmares could be reduced. If I might be a little more specific, the El Paso, let's say there were 500 people in the store and probably 1 out of 500 had a Mace product. If 250 had, then I think there would be a much better chance to have curtailed that particular situation. If the public had knowledge of Mace products, then revenues would skyrocket. I sent you, and last year on the Today Show, there was an interview with a felon that was behind bars that had committed hundreds of attacks, and he stated what he looked for. It was a very thorough interview by the Today Show. He said screaming, spitting, throwing rocks, cameras, none of that ever scared him. But if he saw a person that had Mace, that deterred him, and he would not attack them. I wondered if you guys had seen this. And into social media, why in the world would we not have that throughout Fox News, Home Shopping Network, in various places that people could become aware? Because in schools and churches, in I believe 8 states, they're going to allow teachers to carry guns. I can assure you most teachers don't have a clue about how to shoot a gun, but they could have a mace product or your gel gun, and this is a non-lethal way. So tell me what I'm missing and why we're not executing on that, because I know it's a belief that we get the revenues up, the stock goes up, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it's going to take months to get the revenue up, but this way, if we got the word in social media that this was an idea that is the best idea I know of. I heard a commentator just comment, say, well, it would have been nice if that Walmart had had cameras. Well, I'm sure that Walmart had plenty of cameras. So I'm just not understanding why we miss, not you specifically, but why we miss these opportunities with these mass shootings to let people know we have the product that will work. So tell me what I'm missing here.
Well, there are a lot of tentacles here, Thurman. You know, you're talking about very early on in the selling cycle of awareness and education, and that is what Mark was alluding to, the social media side. But even on social media, you know, there's only so much we can do because of the nature of the product, we cannot advertise it. Okay, so you're left to organically grow your audience, but you can't pay to advertise on Facebook or wherever because of the type of product it is. So there are limitations there. I've long contended that when retail stops looking at this product, and you heard it at Investor Day, as a pure impulse buy and hiding it on one or two hooks in various departments and areas of the store, and actually puts it out front and center as a destination category, all things personal safety, that is when the needle is going to start moving in terms of the public being aware of the product. There were, some estimates put it as high as 3,000 people in that Walmart store down in El Paso. I think 1,000 to 3,000, they weren't sure how many, but a lot of people were in that store. And, you know, the irony is we sell Mace product right there in Walmart. So it's a harder sell than one would imagine in the school systems. They're on a completely different, they all want to stop it, but how they go about it, they don't have a handle on it, and just to go in and offer Mace products to them, they just don't open up the checkbook. And then you're talking about the schools by school by school across the country, and that takes a tremendous amount of resources to do that. So our contention is, we get a program out there in major retail where it gets a lot of attention. It's not hidden back in the automotive section, the back of the store, or hidden in this section of the store, the other corner. But you get it out there where people can actually see it. And we'll do what we can on social media to get the message out. But you know, there are even limits to that. It's a challenge, I'm not going to lie to you, but I think our best bet is to get it in every brick-and-mortar retail place where we can get it, and get it front and center, and get a type of display where a lot of people see it every year.
If I could, Gary, make one follow-up for that. 3 years ago, I took previous management to the largest lobbying company in Washington, introduced them to the firm. They thought it was an absolute great deterrent to mass shootings. They kept the contract with a lobbying firm, which was going to introduce it to senators and going to introduce it to the House of Representatives, and after 2 months, they dropped it. And so while it may be difficult, I don't think it is as difficult as we might think to let people know on social social media and on certain programs, we just in the past have failed miserably on being known as a deterrent to mass shootings. I can assure you, if you asked 1,000 people, maybe one would even know about the Mace gel gun. And while I understand your limitations in advertising, et cetera, I don't understand why senators, congressmen, et cetera, and we can't get this on some social media. We have the interview with the Today Show where the felon stated the story I'm trying to preach. And I just I hope this management team does not ignore the obvious answer to the products that you have and the need to get it into social media, and it would make retail box store sales compared to e-commerce an absolute non-event. And I thank you for taking my questions. I'll get back in the queue.
Okay. Thank you, Thurman.
Your next question is from William Rankin. Your line is now open.
Hey, well, thank you for taking the call. I've been an investor for probably a little over 3 years, and you know, one of the biggest frustrations is the very low trading volume, and I really appreciate your comments really addressing the need to attract more investors. And it seems like when we get on the calls, it's usually the same few people. Nobody new is really coming into the calls, or I don't think many people are reading press releases or hearing about the positive changes that are taking place in the company. And there are low-cost ways to get the Mace story out. And just as a maybe an example, could you share with me how many people are on the call today?
No, I'd prefer not to do that, but there is a similar number over the last several quarters. So it's a steady volume.
All right. Well, just, you know, from my seat, I think there are – I'm an ex-CEO of a public company and spent, you know, been in your shoes and in small company. And there are some ways that you can get the story out to people that aren't expensive and may find more people on the call and could get, you know, caught up in the potential of the company and become investors. And, you know, that's what all of us as investors want to see is, you know, the company to succeed, perform, and see an appreciation in the value of the company and the stock price. So thank you for your efforts.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a follow-up question from Andrew Shapiro. Your line is now open.
Hi, okay. I have some questions here about the Postal Service partnership, and I appreciate you may have to be circumspect about some details as of yet, but others, hopefully, since you've unveiled it at the annual meeting and you have a signed agreement, that there's some big picture things you can shed some light on. So can you elaborate a little bit more on that partnership that you discussed during the annual meeting with you know, where and how you will be, the current agreement has you placing the product. For example, the Postal Service has 30,000 managed, you know, retail post offices or outlets. That's a huge amount. And 800 million retail customer visits in a given year to those outlets. It's obviously a well-known brand. I think you said you're going to offer it on your website and things like that. Just can you explain what you got going on at present and what your agreement calls for down the road, and if you're competitively comfortable, you know, what your hopes are that this relationship evolves to?
I think the program in general, Andrew, is geared towards a specific channel that we're looking at. I don't want to get into that level of detail right now, but it is being presented. We made a couple presentations, been favorably received, and we have a couple more presentations that we'll be giving over the next month or two. And it's a limited product line. There are three SKUs to it. And it's really geared towards a a specific channel that I just don't want to get into at this point. Once it's placed in, once it's placed out there, you'll see where it's going. The brand is well recognized, but and we are able to sell to the Postal Service. That channel is open to us. But that is an effort in itself to get something into the post office. So it's on our radar, and it will be, we will present to them that we're going after a certain channel right now, which is, which will step up quicker than the post office will. So that's about as far as I can go with it. It is being presented, and but like everybody else, you know, when categories are reset, that's on a calendar, and all we can do is once more control the controllables, and we can be ready, but we have to wait for their calendar to come along and tell us when. So we'll have further detail on that I'm sure on the next quarter.
Okay. And with respect to the agreement that's already been signed with this semi-governmental entity, can you describe at all what is expected and the obligations, or minimums, et cetera, are between from each party and the timing and obligations of the party? And also, can you describe the duration of the agreement you've signed so far?
I'll give it a shot. So it is there's a very low fixed fee amount for the use of the license, call it a minimum royalty, along with a modest royalty charge. This is a very, very, very manageable number for us in terms of the fixed minimum. The contract duration, actually, I do not have it in front of me. I want to say it's 3 years. I'm not 100% certain on that, but I believe it's a 3-year arrangement, and it is, you know, it's exclusive to us. So there's no specific volume target or whatever that we have to hit during that period. The royalty number, which I don't want to disclose, but it is also a very comfortable number for us. So we do feel like all things considered, this is a when you take into account that it really is a completely different look and feel and market, if you will, that Gary referred to, these particular channel that we're going into. It's something that very, very modest cost to do that. So it should be a win-win all around.
Right. Yeah. No. It seems like this is a natural for, you know, the retail channels of the, you know, the office product type of retailer or things like that. You mentioned on the last call that you might be able to provide a narrow date range when the program rollout and the revenue generation timing would be starting to kick in. Have we reached that point, and are you able to narrow the date range and window out when this will be, formally rolled out with a, you know, more disclosive press release as well as products, I guess, would be available on the mace.com website?
The USPS brand, we probably won't make available on our website. It may be available on Amazon. As far as a rollout to the retail channels, it's probably going to be, once more, we have to follow their calendar. So the presentations are being made. If somebody accepts the program and they have a calendar category reset in November, we'll ship in November. But more than likely, it's going to be in early, the first two quarters of 2020 is where we're learning everybody has their resets taking place.
And just, you know, to elaborate on that too, I know that seems like a, you know, a long time between the announcement and expectation of revenue. If you think of Kuros as well, which obviously was a little bit more ready to go because it already had placements, but you know there is a lot of behind the scenes work that has to go into delivering these products and having them ready and having them
completely ready to go, so that when a retailer does place an order in their big orders, that's a very seamless thing. So you have to do everything from designing the package to designing the colors to working models to work with, and all that, in addition to, of course, getting the introductions at the various channels that we're looking to. This is not an excuse making statement, but it is a statement that from the time signing an agreement and getting the go ahead from, say, the Postal Service that they agree with your design to actually rolling it out and collecting revenue from it, is something in the neighborhood of 6 months is a pretty decent cadence to think about. So Kuros, obviously we're a little bit we're fairly further along, just because of the fact that was already a product that was out there in the market.
So when you say a retailer resets in Q1, does that mean we ship and book revenues in Q4, or it is in the very same quarter of the reset?
It means that the reset, they will choose new products and put those new products in the store effective Q1. So their decisions, as Gary's explained before, are well ahead of that. So these meetings we're having now, they are actively making decisions in these major retailers right now, and they'll be notifying us, hey, you're in or you're out, or you're expanded or you're contracted. And so that will then point us to the product shipments occur immediately when the store is ready in that, say, first quarter.
And so when you have that much advance notice and they say you're either in or we're not going to add you, is that kind of a binding thing for which you would deem it to be an announceable event once you're green-lighted for a retail channel, or the retailer doesn't want you to be announcing anything until it's actually on the shelves and on the, available in Q1?
Well, as a company, we wouldn't announce it until we have it on the shelves of the store. And then even then, we probably won't go down to the detail level of saying, it's available at this retailer.
Right.
In terms of a press release, okay?
Okay. So,
people find it online and where to buy, it'll tell them which retailers
are. We have a feature on our website that lets people, access the stores that it is available in through the retail level. They're obviously not our stores, but there's no reason we couldn't revisit that. Look, if we got into a chain that we, a retail or a brick and mortar chain, it was absolutely something we've never done before and very exciting, with the permission of that retailer, I'm sure they'd be happy to ride along with our explanation of those partnerships. It's just something that normally is not done day in, day out, but there's no reason we couldn't look at it.
Right. I mean, you wouldn't want to upset other retailers in competitive retailers, because you'd rather place all your product in every sporting goods store rather than a single one. But to the extent when you balance that against the promotion you may be giving to the new one, they may like that promotion. You guys have to figure out, I guess, what you're going to do. I have additional questions. I'll back out into the queue, but please come back to me. I definitely want to talk about and understand these non-cash write-off stuff. Hello?
Yes. Operator, are there other calls in the queue?
Yes, sir. A question came up. A follow-up question from Mr. Truman Willis. Your line is now open.
Going back to the annual meeting just briefly, I want to applaud your efforts. I had sent my 10-point strategy. I'm 70 years old, and I have used this with dozens of companies in taking management to New York, Chicago, Boston, Miami, et cetera, and it's a 10-point strategy to enhance shareholder value. And I've heard you talk about four of them today, and I want to thank you that you're going to be getting out more press releases. I want to thank you that some directors and insiders have bought stock. And my question is, do we think we'll see other insiders buy stock? Because I think all board members ought to own stock in a board of which they serve. So can you comment briefly on that, please? But again, four of the 10 items you have addressed today.
Yeah, Thurman, I think we will see. We have indications from several insiders that following the opening of our next window period for transactions that they will be supporting the company. I think also, as you know, both management as well as board have a significant portion of their compensation that is offered in the form of equity. So both parties are, the board is heavily paid in equity, and management is as well. So both parties are on the same. The same plane as the shareholders are and the investors.
Do we think we might see them buy in the open market, though?
I believe that we might. We don't have any control over that, but we have heard some indications of people that are inquiring how to go about that, and it would not be a surprise to me if they did that.
And one quick, the window opens 2 days today or 3 days from today?
Yeah, our policy is 2 days after 2 days after the earnings release, so it'll be Monday.
But again, thank you for paying attention to the 10-point strategy and adopting some of those measures.
Yeah, we appreciate your sharing that with us. Operator, are there other? We have about 5 minutes to go here.
We have another follow-up question from Mr. Andrew Chaprio. Your line is now open.
Well, 5 minutes, I don't know if you could extend it, but otherwise I would need to schedule an offline call, try to pile through a bunch of these things. Last quarter, I asked about a spike in receivables that you mentioned. The prime cause was a one-time issue expected to successfully resolve eventually. Was this receivable the one that got reserved against here in the second quarter? And is that amount the party's full receivable amount?
Yes. The growth as it worked its way through our aging was a one-time transaction from 2018 that is in a channel that we're no longer participating in. The receivable, unfortunately, as of last quarter, was not even. First quarter I'm referring to was not even due. When it came due in second quarter, we became aware the party was involved in their own litigation and would not be paying us on a timely basis. So we investigated it and felt like a reserve was appropriate in the second quarter, which is when the receivable became past due, and we gained information that they were not intending to pay us currently. That this one matter, the matter that we've referred to in the part as part of the increase in the reserve, is in litigation right now, and we're very comfortable that that there's not a heck of a lot of reasons why this shouldn't be a straightforward breach of contract situation. So we're pretty comfortable that will prevail in it. Then the question is, can we collect anything? So, but it's I will say it's been filed. We're in the early processes of seeing whether they're going to contest this, or if they do, what timeline that'll lead us down towards.
Okay. And where in the income statement again does this AR reserve write-off impact?
So it sits in SG&A.
Okay.
And it's mechanically just we keep the way we do it, Andrew. We keep the reserve, we keep the receivable on the books gross, and put a reserve against it. So you'll see that receivable balance hasn't gone down by the amount. It's just the reserve has gone up, and we'll do that.
The net receivable has gone down.
Exactly. And when,
okay.
We'll keep it that way until this is settled one way or the other.
You mentioned two receivables are in litigation. This is one. Can you quantify the amounts of these two? What this amount we kind of know of. What's the other amount that's in litigation?
The other amount's a little bit larger amount. It's it's less than $500,000, but not a lot less than that. And it is from a sale of a company. It's really from the sale of our surveillance business several years ago that has been the payments ceased and the reserve occurred in the first quarter, but the litigation commenced in the second quarter. We are further along in that process. In fact, we have already received a judgment in Texas in our favor, which is where the company's located, and we are in the process of asset discovery with them. I'm not as optimistic, you know, frankly, on the recovery of the full principal amount on this, but our hope would certainly be that we can get what we can get, and we can certainly get our name off of this business that has gone very south on us. We
right.
don't want our brand damaged any further by this. So at a minimum, we will accomplish that, we believe.
Yeah. And with respect to Q4's notes receivables written down, I think this was one of them, the Texas one. But what is the status and efforts of the company to recover the other owed monies, which I think are more recoverable from the call alarm buyer?
Correct. That one, we had the appropriate basis to write it off for accounting purposes. We're a little more optimistic in that ultimate recovery because of that business is overall much healthier than these other two that we sold,
yep.
we had received from. So we feel like that is a second half of 2019 event where we will have a lot better feel for whether this gets resolved. I mean, we were, you know, this was a significant payment we were receiving monthly that we haven't received since almost a year now. So it's a growing to be a very large number that we've been patient up to now because we're second lien note holders. But the second half of this year is where that has to be resolved one way or the other.
Okay. Now, the manufacturing overhead variances you discussed fairly quickly in your script, can you summarize that again slowly and what has been and what will be done to return back to optimized margin, or are we already in Q3 here now running back at optimized margins?
So I'll let Gary jump in on this as well. There's a couple of the unusual items that I think we've talked about, so we don't need to go back to those, I guess, unless somebody wants to, but they don't get us all the way back to the period over period. 44% was what we were looking at last year at this time, and obviously even with the adjustments, we were, you know, probably in the neighborhood of 7 or 8 percentage points shy of that. There's a couple factors. One factor is that when, you know, your volume tends not to be increasing as much, that you don't absorb as much of your overhead and your labor, and that catches you in the form of a variance, which has happened a bit to us this quarter. The other thing is that if you think that the overall journey that we're on with the company in terms of resetting things, we feel like the top line has gotten a lot of attention. We think that the SG&A costs, while they're not where we want them to be, are under control in the sense of they're running about the same year over year when you strip out some of these crazy items. So the base there is you know, coming along. It's this third piece that really resources are being identified and added to on the manufacturing floor that really is the last of our homework, I think, that we have to do to get those numbers back. And Gary may want to elaborate on some of those steps.
Well,
And Andrew, you saw some of the stuff when you were here for Investor Day, you know, moving to cellular manufacturing out on the floor and automated packing machines and so forth. So there, the hierarchy here is like lean manufacturing, continuous improvement. And I was just meeting with Carl this morning, going over a number of initiatives that are taking place out on the floor. And where we got hit was, you know, with our private label business and order size, you know, there are a lot of small orders that just happened to flush through during the second quarter, and those don't bode well from an efficiency standpoint because, you know, for the way we make product, we'd rather just set up and run, you know, 50,000 of the same thing, not small, much smaller micro lot sizes. And then labor markets are getting tighter and tighter, as everybody can attest to, and so we're not immune to the labor shortage out there. And so with the labor shortage comes with, well, you know, let's get this order done, and then we got to jump over to that order. So it doesn't leave you the cushion to build up inventory in a more efficient manner. So I think those two items contributed heavily in the second quarter, and we're taking a look at the smaller lot sizes now to do more with those on a manufacturing cell base, and the labor, at least right now, we got it under control to where we're starting to build the inventory levels back up. So we should see improvement in the third quarter.
Okay. And would you guys discuss on what has changed and what has not changed with respect to your offering into the tactical and law enforcement market, and elaborate on your rationale supporting your shift in resource allocations, and perhaps break down just the bigger items that comprise those exit costs? Is it like a, you know, is it a lease, or you know, what are the costs of getting out of the less lethal munitions business line?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll handle the cost side of that, and Gary may talk more about the strategy. But on the cost side, we've booked about 140, and we have a little bit more to accrue in the third quarter from an accounting point, but most of it's in the 140. The largest portion of that, about 110, was the cost of inventory that we had in Florida that we were not able to basically, it's difficult inventory to dispose of because it's regulated into munitions. So we entered into an arrangement with a supplier that was able to take that inventory and remove it from our warehouse, and also at the same time cancel our three-year fixed lease that we had in Florida, which we ended up paying another $10,000 on that. So most of the 140 was in the cost of the inventory that we were relieved of, and the lease termination payment, which was that's cost together were less than the cost of the lease would have been. So it really was done at a pretty reasonable amount. The rest of the 140,000 was some deposits and some samples and things of that nature that weren't material.
And when you say a little bit more this quarter, what's a little bit? Below 50,000? Below 10,000?
Well below 50, yes.
Well below 50, yeah.
Okay. Good. And then just elaborating on your strategy and rationale supporting the shift, I know you explained it to me a little bit at the annual meeting, but for the benefit of our listeners?
Yeah, well, we have two product lines we've been selling for a number of years, and that is the takedown line, gel, stream, fogger, foam, as well as another product line, which is the TG Guard product line for prisons and jail cells and things like that. So those two product lines have been here for a while, and then the company entered into the munitions business in 2018, I guess, was their full go at it, and you know, getting the bunker and everything, the supplier lined up, and bringing on a training company that could go around and do training on these munitions. And when we speak of munitions, we're strictly talking about stuff that goes boom for the most part, flashbangs and ear-piercing grenades and the like. So there's blast strips for blowing the doorknobs off of buildings when they want to enter a building, and the type of stuff you see in Hollywood movies. That's the munitions line, and heavily regulated by the ATF. There's a lot of cost that comes with that. You can't outsource that. You have to have a company employee at that bunker with that product. They control it. So that's just on the on our side of it. And then when you go out and try to sell this stuff, and this is why when I came in earlier this year, I wanted to give it a 90 to 180 day review and see if the needle could start moving if we got behind it. And so we put all these resources in place, reps, training, catalogs, the whole nine yards. And quite honestly, I think what everybody underestimated was the amount of time or how long the selling cycle is. It's extremely long. And in my opening comments, I mentioned about $20,000 a month in savings, and I could tell you, Andrew, a lot of the months I've been here was much higher than $20,000 per month. And so I was left with the decision of just keep pumping that type of money in every month after month after month with a selling cycle that might be as long as a year or two. And then even then, when it does hit, you know, what's going to be the dollar volume? And the other part of it that made the decision a little bit easier was the fact that we did not, unlike the takedown line of product, which we manufacture right here in Cleveland, we do not manufacture those munitions. So there's an extra step in the cost side of it. And what happens is when you're competing with companies that are actually manufacturing their own munitions and you have to purchase yours from an outside source, your margins get pinched really, really quickly. So I started laying out a best case scenario in terms of sales and the cost over the next year or two that we would incur getting to that level of sales, and with the margins that I was going to expect at that point of time, knowing that there was a price increase coming in a couple months this year. And I looked at the whole equation and it just didn't spell mother load, you know. It just had a big hole, and I'm thinking, well, I'm going to cut bait and run at this point. We're going to close it down and redeploy the assets. More powerful projects will have a shorter timeline and a much, much quicker payback. So that was, that was in a nutshell, the thinking. Mark, are we out of
all
time?
Right.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. And, operator, I think we've gone a bit over, so if you could, I think we would like to wrap the call up at this point.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you, everyone, for participating. You may now disconnect.
Thank you.
Thank you.